This is Ukraine Calling, a weekly roundup of what's happening in Ukraine with a focus on a main story or two. I'm Bohdan Nahailu, currently with Democracy Reporting International, standing in at Hromadske Radio in Kyiv, and here are some of the main stories from Ukraine.
On behalf of the General Assembly, I have the honor to welcome.
But today, I have to recall that my country has become the object of the external aggression. This time, aggressor is the Russian Federation.
The heart of reform in any country is not the laws which have to change, but the culture that has to change. And in a country like Ukraine, that issue is at the center of the reform process, which is, can you change what has been, let us be honest, a culture of corruption?
Я одразу з доброї новини. Внаслідок бойових дій жоден з українців не був поранений і не загинув.
Ukraine's President Poroshenko traveled to New York this week to attend the United Nations General Assembly. He met with US President Obama, Vice President Biden, and Democratic Party presidential candidate Hillary Clinton. Republican Party candidate Donald Trump did not respond to a meeting request. On Wednesday, Poroshenko addressed the annual gathering of world leaders. He used the occasion to once again say that Russia was using hybrid warfare to fuel global insecurity, while pretending it is not involved in Ukraine. Russia's President Putin, in the meantime, used his UN address to blame the West for upheaval in the Middle East and appeal to everyone to uphold international law. Yet just one day earlier, on the 20th of September, Russia violated international law by holding elections in Crimea as part of their General Duma parliamentary election. United Nations General Assembly Resolution 68262 recognizes Crimea as within Ukraine's international borders. By holding elections on occupied territory, they in fact delegitimized the entire election. The OSCE refused to monitor the polls in Crimea, and neither the EU nor the US recognized those election results. Fewer than half of Crimea's residents went to the polls, 47% and 40% in Sevastopol. In villages where the majority population is Crimean Tatar, such as Pionerska, voter turnout was as low as 7 to 8%. International figures joined Ukraine's decision and opinion makers at this year's Yalta European Strategy meeting in Kyiv this week. It's an annual gathering started 13 years ago by one of Ukraine's richest men, Viktor Pinchuk, with the aim of promoting Ukraine's European integration. For the past 3 years, it's been held in internal exile in Kyiv, since Yalta, the original venue, is no longer available to Ukrainians. This year, Hollywood star Kevin Spacey stole the show, with seemingly everyone lining up to take selfies with him. U.S. journalist Farid Zakharia had a sober message for Ukrainians. Putin's goal is to drive a wedge between the U.S. and the EU and to use that wedge to get rid of sanctions. More on this and on the Yes conference later on. And in the war zone, for the first time since Ukraine Calling started airing, there was a day in Ukraine's war zone when no one was killed or injured. That was Sunday, the 18th of September. Overall, there was a noticeable decrease in the intensity of hostilities. And on Wednesday, the 21st, the Minsk Trilateral Contact Group announced that an agreement had been reached, a framework for withdrawing troops and weapons from three villages along the front line was in place, supposedly. Although this is only one step towards peace, it was the first breakthrough in many months of talks, even if it did smack of déjà vu or entendu. During the past week, only one Ukrainian soldier was killed and 14 were wounded. Ironically, the leader of a plot, the separatist organization, Yevhen Zhilin from Kharkiv, was shot dead in a Moscow restaurant on the 19th of September by an unknown assassin. He was renowned for his pro-Russian position and opposition to the Euromaidan movement. And at home, Ukraine's government submitted a draft budget on schedule for the first time in the country's modern history. For 2017, the Groysman government set out priority areas as defense and security, infrastructure, energy efficiency, agriculture, and decentralization of state power. The proposed deficit is 3% of GDP, down from 3.7% in 2016. International economists call the budget balanced and realistic, though parties considering themselves in opposition continue to resort to populist rhetoric and denounce recent austerity measures. And as for culture and music, three more festivals should be mentioned that occurred this week. The second International Literature Festival started in Odessa, or is about to start, on the 28th of September and runs through until the 1st of October. The program is available on their Facebook page. We'll post a link on our show's webpage. And in Kharkiv, the 8th annual Diteko Festival happened this week. It's organized by the Kharkiv Oblast Regional Council to highlight children's and youth television programming. There are workshops, masterclasses, concerts, bonfires, and a competition for best TV program and film. Well, I'm very happy that in this stand-in program for a dear colleague of mine, I have two good friends, two seasoned journalistic campaigners, veterans of the trade, who know Ukraine very well, but more importantly, know the outside world very well. And briefly, to just introduce them, I have David Satter sitting here, who used to be the Moscow correspondent for the Wall Street Journal and has written many tomes and articles telling us about the realities of this part of the world, and continues to do so. In fact, I met him last week at the Lviv Publishers Book Fair, where he was signing copies of his book and also giving talks on his perceptions of things. And directly across from me, I'm very happy to see again Brian Bonner, who is the editor of the Kyiv Post, again, has been here for quite a few years. Let's start off with the US. David, very exciting times for all because of the uncertainty as to the outcome of the US presidential elections. What's your reading at the moment on how Ukraine is perceived and how things could change depending on the outcome of the election?
Well, I think that Ukraine is understood to be the victim of aggression. And this perception is fairly clear. I mean, it's not something that is in doubt. And I think that basic underlying reality will shape U.S. policy after the election, no matter who is the new president, because the world has a deep stake in not only not rewarding, but making clear the unacceptability of land grabs like the Russian seizure of Crimea, and the unacceptability of artificially fomented civil wars disguised international aggression. So these are the basic things that underlie the relationship right now. And those are very fundamental issues that I think are not going to go away, no matter who's the next president.
But there is a lot of concern, and I think Brian will support me on that, he being based here in Kyiv, that should Trump win, there will be a sea change, that it'll be a game-changing situation. Brian, what's your take?
I think this is a very dangerous, the most dangerous and most volatile American election I've seen, and I'm 57 years old almost.
But is it going to make a difference, or will, how much of it is posturing beforehand and populism, and how much of it will be realpolitik at the end of the day?
You know, Ukraine has not fallen off the radar, I think, of the U.S. I think that was shown today, well, shown yesterday, Obama's final speech to the U.N. General Assembly. He had a shout out to Ukraine once, and he criticized Russia twice. We saw the sit down with Clinton. We saw the sit down with Joe Biden. So I think it seems clear. It was really a funny role reversal that the Democratic Party is now looking to be stronger on Ukraine than the Republican Party. And as David knows, that is quite a role reversal from previous politics. Although I have to say, when it comes to Ukraine, there's been tremendous bipartisan support. Some would say bipartisan neglect, but bipartisan support.
David?
I can only give you the way it you know, I'm perceiving things in the U.S., and that is that Trump is attempting to appeal to his domestic supporters. And if he praises Putin, it's not because he necessarily knows a lot about Putin, but because he's trying to project the image of someone who will vigorously defend American interests by comparison, for example, with Obama. When he talks about conditional support for the NATO alliance, he's trying to indicate to his supporters that he's going to definitely insist on a greater contribution from foreign countries. And remember that his base of support are people who have suffered as a result of various international trade deals, feel that the United States has lost its position in the world. There are other signs, not so visible to the public, that in fact, if Trump does win, which is far from a certainty, he'll be obliged to rely on the Republican foreign policy establishment, which is thoroughly supportive of Ukraine. And I think that a lot of this pre-election rhetoric will be seen in retrospect to have been a lot less important than people give it credit for being.
Often I hear from my Ukrainian colleagues, the world doesn't understand us, it doesn't support us enough, etc. If they were in our shoes, they would think differently. David, and somebody that's just flown in from Washington, what's your take on this?
Well, I think that the people in Ukraine do have a reasonable understanding of the West. In fact, in general, it's easier to understand something that's normal and logical than for someone who comes from a society that's democratic and based on law to understand a society that's lawless and very idiosyncratic. But I think that even given the level of understanding that many Ukrainians have, and this is also true for other citizens of the former Soviet republics, they don't draw the right lessons. They don't seem to make the connection between the kind of individual self-discipline and moral integrity that are expected in a democratic society and the prosperity and success of those societies. There's oftentimes a disconnect in which people, of course, are entranced by the well-being that they see in the West, but they can't, either in their own lives or in their relations to other people, kind of get it together to understand that this doesn't happen automatically, that it also requires a certain commitment, not just on the level of institutions, but at the individual level. And that the failure to make that commitment or even to understand it in many cases is very destructive for the ultimate goal. I mean, it's interesting that I've always been fascinated by the fact that rich people in the United States, after they accumulate a lot of money, oftentimes want to do good with that money. That means they may establish a foundation, for example, or they give money to charities that are worthwhile. Whereas in the former Soviet Union, it seems as if although they may make minor gestures in the direction of supporting good works, the accumulation of money is directly connected to ever more greedy consumption. Well, that's a fundamental difference, and that reflects something very basic about social attitudes, about individual attitudes, and it'll be necessary for people in Ukraine to go through a period even of self-examination. Yeah, if they want to help reconstruct this society and make of it the kind of highly successful place it could be under the right circumstances.
So is the battle about values, direction, or about wealth, distribution of parts of the pie?
All three are linked: values, direction, and wealth.
This is all, we're getting down to the really fundamental psychological attitudes that underpin, ultimately, the corruption. Because if the individual isn't worth anything, and if those in authority think that the only thing that matters is having their hands on the levers of power, is it any wonder that there's corruption on the part of the office holders who don't fear anything and it being held accountable? And indifference and resignation despair on the part of the ordinary citizens who feel that there's nothing they can do. So this as much as anything else. I mean, we can talk all we want about some of the bureaucratic, structural, institutional changes that can be made, that ought to be made. We can talk about the influx of foreign assistance, which, of course, is very helpful. But what ultimately is going to change things, and what is ultimately really the key, I think, is this set of attitudes.
Well, I wanted to say, you know, now wearing my Democracy Reporting International hat, whom I represent at the moment here in Kyiv, I'm somewhat reassured by changes in attitudes, especially among younger people. I think the younger generation, particularly the educated generation, they're not going to take this anymore. And they are not looking for the easy way out simply to emigrate. Many of them do. But many want to stay. They want to earn a decent living, but they want to live in a civilized, modern, flourishing European democracy. And I've been very encouraged to see that despite all the blemishes, despite, you know, the warts and all syndrome that we live in, that there is this dynamism inherited from the Maidan or projected by the Maidan, which is still persevering despite the immense obstacles and the immense conservatism and old practices that persist. Brian, how do you see it?
I think that the ruling elite since the Maidan have been stalling and trying to obstruct and trying to keep things going, keep the system in place, but they are encountering fierce resistance. And that was one of the solutions that was cited by Mikhail Saakashvili and Mustafa Nayyem, some of the other young reformers at the YES conference. What is the solution? New elections, new elite. It's going to happen. The soldiers who are fighting for the country in the East are not going to put up with coming back to a lawless society where they're not getting the benefits, where there's two classes of people, you know, the ultra rich and the majority are poor, and the middle class is small. I would like to say, and this is by no means excusing the corruption that is going on and that is not being fought, and the polite term is lack of political will. And the impolite term would be obstructing justice. But David is one of the ones who has figured out Putin long before most other journalists. And, you know, Ukraine would be helped a lot if it didn't have to spend 5% of its meager gross domestic product on the military, if it didn't have to worry about invasion, if it wasn't in the middle of war. Do you think Putin is going to give Ukraine that breathing space it needs?
Well, I don't think he intends to at all. And what we've seen, even you know, recently, there was a big massing of troops on the Russian border, intended, of course, to create the impression that war was imminent. And this, I think we'll see this periodically. He's going to use whatever instruments are available to him to destabilize the situation here. And as you say, Brian, to create the conditions for the Ukrainian authorities to be unable to undertake a lot of the things they'd maybe like to undertake. And this is not surprising, because the fact is that Ukraine and Russia are different in a lot of ways, but there are enormous similarities. And from the point of view of Russians, success in the democratic transformation of Ukraine would be of tremendous significance. And in fact, I think that there's kind of a psychological battle going on right now. If Ukraine can establish a working and successful democratic model and in a country which was once part of the Soviet Union and for so long was part of the Russian Empire, that would have an immense effect on Russia. And by the same token, if Russia can destabilize the situation in Ukraine and cause Ukraine to revert, in effect, to authoritarian practices, that would be a huge victory for the regime in Russia. So the future, in many ways, it's not an exaggeration to say that the future of the region is being played out here in Ukraine to a great extent, and that the good that can be done here will have effect beyond the borders of the country itself.
And yet Russia would like us to think in terms of the great game being continued, you know, the sort of struggle for mastery in Europe between East and West, with Russia defending one set of values and one approach to Europe and the East with and the West with America, the sort of transatlantic alliance, if you want, representing this nefarious other. Why do you think, as somebody that lived in Russia and worked there for so long, why did Russia manage to slip so easily back into that mindset after the years of Yeltsin, after sort of dispensing with imperial thought and imperial ambitions, at least ostensibly on the surface?
Well, they never did. And in fact, the years of Yeltsin were a huge failure because they didn't establish any change, and they didn't work for any change in the mentality of people. The country was lawless under the communists. It was even in many ways more lawless under Yeltsin. It continues to be lawless under Putin. Yes, it's true that Yeltsin accepted the territorial status quo, but Russia was in a condition where it really could do little else. And even in those years, even in the early 90s, there were constant references to the suffering of the Russians who lived outside of the territory of the Russian Federation. And this was nothing less than putting down a marker for future aggression, because there was no real suffering. And in fact, it's hardly the responsibility for Russia to defend the rights of Russian, ethnic Russians living in countries like Ukraine and Latvia and so on. That's the responsibility of the Ukrainian and Latvian governments, because these are their citizens now. And it was only, you know, this was, of course, and even to bring it up was disgraceful, because the most prominent precedent for that was Hitler's use of the Sudeten Germans as a as an excuse for taking, first of all, annexing part of the Sudetenland, and then the rest of Czechoslovakia, all but Slovakia.
Well, we see that, you know, Putin has a very selective approach to history and historical memory. I mean, he's just said yet again this week that there was absolutely nothing wrong with the Soviet Union making a non-aggression pact with Nazi Germany, which ended in the division of Poland, the dismemberment of Poland, etc. But okay, let's move on, because time is running out now. Today's latest developments in Minsk, yet another supposed separation of the forces declared. Brian, your take is this yet another play to you know, grandstanding before the respective donors and stakeholders, or could it be that finally, you know, Putin is willing to at least freeze the situation as it is?
Well, I'm with David on this one. I think he's got to show the West that he's doing something. But in reality, I'll believe that he's interested in peace when he withdraws the weapons, withdraws the troops, gives control of the border back to Ukraine, allows international monitors to go everywhere.
Gentlemen, I thank you very much. David Satter, renowned journalist, courageous figure who stole the story as it is and not as how...
And got kicked out of Russia for that.
And got kicked out of Russia, but is highly respected by his peers and colleagues and on the Hill and elsewhere. Brian Bonner, seasoned campaigner too here, a representative of a free democratic press, setting an example for all and sundry here in Kyiv. I thank you very much for your participation.
Thank you, Barga.
Thank you.
A song for you this week is called Night in the Big City, performed by Andriy Sachevich with Dana Vinnitska. It is dedicated to those killed in Kyiv's Maidan. And looking forward, next week there will be a series of events in Kyiv to commemorate the 75th anniversary of atrocities in Babyn Yar. The ravine was on the outskirts of Kyiv during the Second World War. German forces and their local collaborators massacred close to 34,000 Jews there on the 29th to 30th of September 1941. Other victims of German massacred on the site were Soviet prisoners of war, Ukrainian nationalists, communists, and Roma. Historians estimate that between 100 to 150,000 people were killed at Babyn Yar during the German occupation. Babyn Yar has become a major symbol of the Holocaust, something that was largely silenced during the Soviet era. This year's events include a youth conference, a public symposium, a memorial space competition, and a commemorative concert. Ukraine Calling will post a link to the entire program on the show's website. We will be watching this and other stories in Ukraine. Tune in next week for a new episode of Ukraine Calling. If you have any suggestions or comments, please write to the show at ukrainecalling@hromadskeradio.org. I'm Bohdan Nahailo in Kyiv, and thanks so much for listening.